Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Chances are good that you came in contact with something made from recycled material today. A can of soda, the carpeting in your office building, or the smartphone that is an arm's length or less away. They are all part of a swirling cycle of old items fed back into the production of new stuff. And the more we buy, the more we need to recycle. But where does all of that recycled material ultimately end up? Adam Minter is Shanghai correspondent for Bloomberg View. He followed the trail of trash and found that most of it ends up in China and India. He's author of Junkyard Planet, Travels in the Billion-Dollar Trash Trade, and we spoke with him when the book was first released. It's now out in paperback. A billion-dollar trash trade. Who is profiting from all that waste?
Well, it's everybody from the local scrapyard down the street in New Hampshire there to large-scale exporters of scrap metal and paper on the West and East Coast ports like Los Angeles and in New Jersey. And more than ever, it's Chinese scrap metal importers and processors, the people who are bringing in it's just $40 billion of American recyclables annually and transforming them into products that range, as you said, from cardboard boxes to automobile parts. It's an extraordinary story. It's the hidden story of globalization, and it's only growing.
The scale is huge. But my question, why does the U.S. export that waste to places like China instead of just recycling it here?
Sure. Well, the simple answer is that the U.S. just simply generates more recycling, more waste than it's capable of processing at home. On average, the U.S. exports about 40% of the recycling that it generates. And most of that recycling isn't, despite what most people may think, put into your recycling bin. It's recycling that's generated in factories, printing plants, by power companies when they replace new cables. And a lot of that kind of material, it's just too much excess of it to be handled in U.S. manufacturing facilities. So, for example, in China, they have the largest copper manufacturing industry in the world. So if you have a power line, more likely than not, that power line was manufactured in China. And so, in a sense, the story of recycling today is a story not just about recycling, but it's about manufacturing. As we all know, China's become the manufacturing juggernaut of the world, and because of that, it needs raw materials, and recycled materials are the cheapest and most efficient raw materials out there.
Is there an alternative to sending waste overseas? What you do in the book is paint this pretty stark scenario, environmentally speaking, an increase in mining for ore. So talk to us a little bit about those trade-offs.
Right, yeah. Well, I mean, one of the things that I state in the book, and I believe it quite strongly, is the worst recycling, and there's some very environmentally damaging recycling, is still better than the best mining. And by that I mean, simply this. Digging a hole in, a Tibetan mountainside to dig out copper ore is an invariably very, very destructive and very dangerous activity. It's far safer and far cleaner to ship a bunch of power lines from the United States to South China where they can be stripped, not necessarily in factories that meet, U.S. health and safety standards, but certainly much healthier, safer, and much less environmentally destructive than digging massive holes in the ground. And that goes for plastics, which require some very dangerous facilities to recycle, but they tend to be lighter on the environment than digging an oil well, say, in the South China Sea. These are very hard decisions and very hard choices that we all have to face as consumers and as people who consume raw materials. They're not black and white, despite how they tend to be depicted in the mainstream media that, exporting your recycling to China is bad. As I tell people, China is going to manufacture stuff. They're going to make new iPhones. They're going to print books, and they're going to get the raw materials to do that. So we have to ask ourselves, how would we like them to get those raw materials? If we cut off the flow of recycling from the U.S. to China, they're going to go get those raw materials somewhere else. I think there are ways to encourage China to do better, and they have been doing better in the 11 years I've covered the industry. There's a long way to go, but compared to what the situation could be, I think the recycling system is very good.
Well, Adam, one of the things that just shocked me is how many people in the world are employed in this recycling business.
Yeah.
Can you give us any idea of the numbers?
Well, the actual numbers are really hard to come by, and they're really variable because it depends on how you look at it. But after agriculture, the activity which occupies more people than any other in the developing world is recycling. And that may be just going through people's trash bins and working as a peddler, because that's basically the job opportunity of last resort, to working in some of the highly industrialized facilities that I show in the book, both in pictures and write about. So if you can come up with total agricultural employment, it's a number less than that. And it's just absolutely astonishing. The longer you spend in the developing world, how many people you actually see engaged in this.
We're speaking with Adam Minter, Shanghai correspondent for Bloomberg Worldview and author of the new book, Junkyard Planet: Travels in the Billion-Dollar Trash Trade. How has the global economic crisis that began in 2008 affected the scrap export industry here in the U.S.?
Well, 2008 was a watershed moment for the global scrap industry, and especially for the U.S. industry itself. You know, for the better part of 15 years, the U.S. industry had grown significantly because of China's demand for raw materials. But when the global economy collapsed, China's demand for raw materials collapsed. Remember, China's an export economy. They need markets to sell the stuff they make, everything from, you know, the iPhones to the books they print. Well, when U.S. consumers and EU consumers stopped buying all that stuff, the Chinese stopped demanding raw materials, and as a result, all of the recyclables that had been flowing to China basically stopped. And you had a situation in the U.S. where recycling warehouses were filling up with cardboard with nowhere to send it, because the Chinese simply didn't need it anymore. And a lot of people were appalled, towards the end of 2008. These recycling warehouses simply didn't have anywhere else to send the stuff, so they started sending it to landfills and incinerators. And that was also something that was occurring in the EU. To this day, as we all know, the global economy hasn't completely recovered from 2008, and neither, for that matter, have scrap exports from the U.S. or the EU. They still lag from where they were in 2007, which was the biggest year ever of the global recycling industry. You know, if things continue as they do, it looks like things will be back to normal, or whatever normal means, in 2014, 2015. But it's, you know, as I said earlier, the story of globalized recycling is really a story of manufacturing. And that's a story of how much people want to consume. In 2008, people stopped consuming, and as a result, the world stopped recycling.
How about now, though, Adam? You're giving us this picture of what you call sludge-filled landfills, burning plastic, you know, a picture that we don't necessarily want to see when we're buying something on the supermarket shelves. And recently, you had an interview with Atlantic Cities and said, stop buying so much crap in the first place. Can I just say cynically, good luck with that. Are we really going to jam up the system, especially if there's so much legacy waste?
Oh, I agree with you completely. I mean, I want an iPhone upgrade, too. You know, I want a new car, too, you know. And I also feel that people in China and India should have the right to those things as well. There's no getting around getting people to stop buying stuff. What I encourage people to do, and I encourage them towards the end of the book, is start thinking about products that last longer, that can be repaired and upgraded, that don't need to be cycled out every 18 months. In the end, you're only holding off the garbage man and the recycling man for a little while longer, but it's a more practical approach, shall I say, than, you know, telling people to stop buying so much crap. But when I said that to the Atlantic Cities, I was sort of getting at that point.
Adam, you come from a family with scrap dealers in your history.
Sure.
Were you raised to recognize the value of trash and scrap? I mean, did your family recycle before everybody else was doing it?
Yeah, well, I like to say we recycled before anybody had ever heard the word recycling. The word recycling came in the 1920s, and my grandfather was already recycling on the streets of Minneapolis in the 19-teens.
Huh.
It's very much a part of the family ethic.
Adam, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that was our earlier conversation with Adam Minter, Shanghai correspondent for Bloomberg View and author of Junkyard Planet: Travels in the Billion-Dollar Trash Trade.